We are coming into a period of history where we are giving birth to a form of humanity that is going to be deeply, fully, consciously saturated with the divine, with everything that implies a complete change of heart, change of mind, change deep in our body, a change in how our body operates. This is the work of the hour. To manifest that oneness, to manifest that creative energy, that divine energy fully into our lives.
Hello, I'm Julie Kroll. You're listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. Each week we gather right here to make connections that break through the illusion of separation. Welcome. Your journey of conscious evolution continues right here, right now. Several years ago, I asked God, Creator Source, how to teach my clients about the breakdowns and breakthroughs of conscious evolution, how to help them relax as systems and structures designed in humanity's collective stage of separation needed to evolve. They no longer served us or represented who we are. It was time to co-create new, innovative systems designed in unitive consciousness, for the wholeness of humanity as an evolving species and planetary organism. As I asked for guidance, I had a powerful vision. There was a bunch of children on a beach furiously building cities of sandcastles. They would rush to get as much done as they could before the waves came in and washed them all away. After the wave receded, the children would dig back in and begin quickly building before the next wave returned to destroy their creations. Farther up on the beach were young adults building a stone wall to protect the elaborate sand sculptures they had created. They were hauling large boulders in hopes that the waves wouldn't touch what they had built. Sure enough, one large wave crested, spilling and splashing over the wall, and their art was lost. Up on land, across the street from the beach, old men were scurrying to board up their homes and protect their businesses. Hammers and nails, drills and screws, sheets of plywood, mounds of sandbags, they were all working diligently to protect their property. Unbeknownst to those on the beach, these older men were preparing for the devastation of an upcoming hurricane. When I looked up at the sky, I saw a web of light, a field of creative consciousness spanning from horizon to horizon. The light was playing with the world below like a marionette pulling strings. It was all part of the evolutionary process from the children to the old men. And there was a whole new world beyond those preparing for the hurricane that no one knew was there. And more behind that. The wholeness was simple and complex. The lesson was powerful. The evolution was part of the whole dynamic living system. In his final vision, Chris Beige describes a similar vision with generations of humanity, the rising and falling of life forms as part of, I quote, a throbbing, dynamic, living whole that was throwing up generation after generation of living beings and then reabsorbing them into itself, like waves washing up on a beach. What does this larger cosmic perspective tell us about our emerging evolutionary capacities? What does it teach us about being a co-evolutionary partner with life? In our first conversation with Chris, we talked about the future human. In the second, we explored the mind of the universe. Now, in this third conversation, we're going to focus on the integration of Chris's experience and his learnings. We hope to harvest what it can teach us about our breakdowns and breakthroughs during this historical time of transformation on the planet. I invite you to take a few deep, conscious breaths. Bring your awareness to your heart. Open your mind and settle into your essential wholeness as I introduce my co-host. Dr. Paul J. Mills is professor of public health and family medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of the award-winning book, Science, Being and Becoming, The Spiritual Lives of Scientists. Hey, Paul, I'm really excited to be back and have this third conversation with Chris and, of course, be with you. Hello there.
Hello there, Julie. It is great to be together again. And hello again, Chris. It's great to be with you. And I'm going to introduce you now for those who haven't heard our first two sessions together. So Dr. Chris M. Baish is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Youngstown State University, where he taught for 33 years. He is also adjunct faculty at the California Institute of Integral Studies and Emeritus Fellow at the Institute for Noetic Sciences. He's an award-winning teacher and international speaker. Dr. Baish has written really several books, including what we are focusing on here for Main Street Mystics. And the title of that book is LSD and the Mind of the Universe, Diamonds from Heaven. And I want to kick off our interview. I think we're ready. For our conversations, I was reflecting on what we've covered so far. And Julie, you were getting at some of this, that we've considered such a broad breadth of topics, from aspects of our individual human experience as a person on out to humanity's ongoing earthly and cosmic journey. And for this session, I particularly want to cover a couple of topics that I think are really relevant to many people's day-to-day experiences. And one of the ones I want to start out with has to do with our sense of lovability and belongingness and worthiness. And Chris, in one of your chapters, and this was the one, A Benediction of Blessings, you had all these prior journeys, and this is a latter chapter in a latter session, and you write about there was this, quote, small, stubborn remnant of unlovability. And you describe how you faced that, you got through it, and then the remnants, let's say, the rewards that you reaped having gotten through it. And I'd like you to speak about this initially because, again, many of us have this. And I think what you wrote gave me more insight into how that experience, that belief that many of us are socialized with from a young person on, how it affects our spiritual journey and how important it is to find the root of it and then move through it.
Hi, Paul. Julie, it's good to be with you again. Yeah. Gee, what can I say about that? You know, there are all sorts of levels to this unlovability, huh? Some of it we pick up from our parents or circumstances or life experience. And then underneath that, there's that deeper sense of unlovability that sometimes reflects a deeper existential uncertainty or confusion. And if we don't understand, and if we don't feel the universe's love for us or the divine's love for us, it just kind of pushes us away from ourselves. That particular session, you know, I don't quote the whole of that session in the manuscript, but when I went to the very source of, in my case, it happened to focus on something coming out of my childhood, out of my early life. And I had already had many experiences that had shown me that the universe loves me, that the divine loves me. But that's what pushed up to the surface, that sense of personal history, which kind of said, I'm not good enough. I can maybe never be good enough. And when that was faced, confronted, and resolved, it just opened up my heart to allow the universe's love in more deeply. And once you kind of go deeply into the universe's love, it flushes out all those kind of smaller fragments of unlovability. And it opens you up to these tidal waves of love that once you experience them, you never doubt. After that, you never can doubt. And you may not understand why the universe is working things out the way it is, or why the divine has made the choices it's made, or life has made the choices it's made, but you never doubt that there is a love behind it, an intelligence and a love behind it.
Thank you.
Chris, that I that spawns a couple different questions for me, but I'm going to begin with this very direct one. With that experience, you write a lot about the purification process, and I'm wondering if this self-love piece has a direct relationship with the purification that you went through in your journey of 20 years of psychedelic, the whole process. And let me just preface it with this, because I think this is fascinating. Okay, I'm going to keep that one question for you, but I do want to say this for our listeners, because if they have not listened to the first two conversations that we've had with you, the first two episodes, they may not know that you've had this 20-year journey with 73 different sessions of psychedelics. And the thing that I will lead us to later, because I think it's an important part, is that this journey wasn't one episode that was isolated and then you have another one. You even referred to it when you were talking in response to Paul's question. You remembered that session and you remembered that you didn't write the whole thing. Like, they became one integrated whole experience in 73 different emerging pieces of art and experience that came through you. So I'm going to ask about that in a second, because I think it's important. But I do want to know if there's a direct correlation, because a lot of our listeners are those spiritual seekers, and they understand purification and those kinds of stages of awakening. And I'm wondering if the self-love piece has a direct relationship or correlation with the purification process.
Absolutely. It certainly does. Basically, purification lifts out of your system anything and everything which is standing between your innate divine nature, reuniting with or opening to the universe's divine nature, the divine nature in its totality. So anything which is in the way has to be lifted from you, even things that you can't understand at the time. We can understand personal wounds, like maybe personal unlovability. We can understand traumas that we collect, things like this. But some of the wounds have to do with our evolutionary saga. Some of the wounds have to do with deep, deep events that took place in the creation of our planet, in the creation of the species within that planet, and those very ancient kind of wounds. And some of the wounds have to do with time and space itself. There's a contraction of consciousness that takes place usually when we incarnate inside time and space, so that time and space itself have to be purified if we're going to experience states of awareness that transcend those limits and reconnect us with infinite time, infinite spaciousness.
One of the things I so appreciate about that description, and you've hinted at that at some of our earlier two conversations. And for me, when I hear that, I think it should take the pressure off us as individual human beings for a lot of the things that we carry, which are kind of a weight of being a human being, the weight, the psychic weight, the soul weight of being incarnated. A lot of the things that we carry, and maybe we personalize too much, we just spoke about unlivability, is really just part of the human experience that is not ours individually per se, but part of the grand phenomenon and even the grand scheme of the Creator's manifestation of this universe that we're participating in and supporting. So with that said, I'd like to ask a question. And my first question had to do with more the individual human experience. This gets to what you were just speaking about, really the incarnation of humanity itself. And in your book, you speak of the quote form, and you have it in capitals, F-O-R-M, that this is the underlying really architecture of humanity itself. And that this form has been learning and evolving through space-time over the eons. And that this form is really what's going to bring humanity, our awakening, the future human. That it's going to, I don't know if this was correct to say, perhaps create or guide the creation of the future human and into our enlightenment. Will you speak a bit, Chris, about this form and your understanding of it and how each of us have contributed to this beautiful, beautiful story of humanity?
Yeah, I capitalized form to emphasize this. This is not personal. Jung touches on this in his concept of the collective unconscious. I think it goes much deeper than that. It has to do with the fundamental structure of our bodies functioning and our minds functioning. So let's just focus just on our minds functioning. We can think of this something like Rupert Sheldrake's concept of morphic fields and formative causation, so that every individual basically is informed by the form of the human being, the underlying archetypal form. And while individuals are learning, their learning accumulates at an individual level, and it also accumulates at a deep collective common level. And I think this basically creates an extraordinary laboratory for evolution, because we are all learning, and our learning collects at the individual level, at the collective level, but the collective level doesn't show its learning very obviously. Individuals can show their learning quickly and obviously at the soul level, but the collective level does not. But it continues to learn, it continues to learn, it continues to acquire, continues to mature. And as the individual members of our species mature, the central form continues to mature. And I think we're approaching, as we talked about in our first discussion, we're approaching a point in history where what's happening is that the form underlying humanity is getting ready to make a movement into its next iteration, its next development. Everything we're doing is contributing to this transition. The birth of the future human, the birth of the diamond soul, is a shift at this fundamental level, I think. And so that every human being born after this multi-generational shift takes place will be operating out of a different matrix, so to speak, or operating out of a different consensus underneath us.
I wrote down a quote when you use the word form too, because I think it's important. And some of our listeners may say, well, the shift has already happened, and some will say it's going to happen. And to me, that's irrelevant when we really understand this process that we're in right now. But you said, and I think this is important, you said that our entire history is alive within our living form, capital F-O-R-M, and subject to rapid change under the right conditions. So what do you mean here about with the rapid change, is subject to rapid change under the right conditions? And what are the right conditions? Because I know so many that are ready for that rapid change, and others are fighting and resisting and not knowing. And I think this is an important part of our conversation in season two about what's turning on right now for humanity. So what do you mean by that the entire history is alive in the form and subject to rapid change under the right conditions?
We can look at this from an individual level, and we can look at it at an anthropological collective level. And I think the processes are fundamentally, they mirror each other. So what we say of one translates into the other. And when you say people are just eager and wanting to participate in this pivot, in this change, and some people are resisting it, that's very, very true at an individual level. I think the dynamic is perhaps a little, I don't know whether resistance is part of it at the collective level, but the basic idea, I think, is that the more we learn, the more we grow. The more we grow, the more we change. The more we change, sooner or later, we come to a point, and this is from a reincarnational perspective, not necessarily within one lifetime, but more visibly within multiple lifetimes. The more we change, eventually, there is some profound shift in our external manifestation. in our level of intelligence, of our level of compassion, some deep change, not just in kind of the soft patterns, but the deep patterns of our life that allows the learning that we've acquired to manifest in the physical world. And these can be dramatic, where a person changes from a condition of disease to a condition of health, from a condition of normal learning to a condition of mystical learning, of deep spiritual learning. The same thing happens, I think, at a collective level. So what I mean is that when I say our entire history is alive within the form, it reflects the insight that there is a consciousness which holds the entire experience of humanity in its awareness, just as I hold my incarnation's awareness, history in my awareness. My soul holds all of my incarnated lives in its awareness. There is an intelligence, there is a consciousness that holds all of humanity's history in its awareness. Now, that just boggles the mind to imagine how it does that and what that looks like. And I've proposed a concept of a metachoic system based on Stan Grof's concept of a choic system, just to hypothesize that how the collective psyche organizes its memories of the history of humanity. But it holds that history in its awareness, and it's learning, it's growing, it's changing. And I think we are reaching this point where it has acquired so much understanding and so much development that it's ready to manifest a change in its basic structure. Now, we also hold our history in our soul history. And so there's this dynamic going on between our individual souls and what I think we could call the species soul. The species soul, the conditions that I think which contribute to reaching this tipping point, I think of in terms of an analogy with physical systems when they move from an equilibrium state into a non-equilibrium state or far from equilibrium state. When the whole system becomes hyper-aroused, hyper-energized, then that system becomes susceptible to different patterns manifesting, we learn a lot from studying in chaos theory, physical systems when they reach non-equilibrium conditions, the capacity for rapid change, the capacity for bringing out from within itself unprecedented rules of nature, patterns of nature, when small perturbations can produce large consequences. The whole system is becoming energized. The whole system is kind of coming to a tipping point. And at that point, small changes can produce dramatic consequences. So then we ask the question, what are we talking about? What would it take to take an entire species into that species soul into a hyper-aroused state? And I think we're watching that unfold, or we can see it coming in the massive global systems crisis, which is being driven by global climate change or this cascading series of ecological crises that the scientists are predicting. We see the struggle taking place in the global conference today, this week, on global climate change. There is going to be an unparalleled quantity of suffering that's going to come to us over the next century. And it's going to be happening not only to our individual lives, but we're going to be watching it on TV happening into lives all around the world. It's going to be terribly painful. I think it's going to hurt so much, and it's going to scare us so much, and it's going to impact us so deeply that we will eventually reach a point where we will literally be screaming and saying, we have to be able to do better than this. We must find a way of being better than this. My visionary experience is it's when the human species is pushed into the corner of desperate circumstance, is pushed in the corner of hyper-arousal because of these increasingly untenable circumstances, when we will be willing to change in a way that we're not willing to change right now, when things are calmer. And I think that's what we're coming into collectively. And I think that's what happens to us individually, doesn't it? things happen in our lives. We're not willing to change. Things keep happening. And we reach a point where we desperately need to change and we make choices of change.
I can follow up on that. So I understand what you're saying about humanity. We need something to prod us, to wake us up to our deep compassion and willingness to change. Is that something that the underlying form that we've been speaking about needs to learn at this point, or is it not so much related to that architectural form of humanity, but more back to us as the individuals? Do you see what I'm seeking? I'm trying to understand, does the form still need another learning or two for us to go forward?
I think it's a both-and situation. And I think the situation that we're entering historically was not created by the form that we are underneath our individual awareness. There is an intelligence that manifests the evolving processes of life on this planet. There was a time when, within a very short period of time, our brain size increased 50%, an evolutionary pivot point. The old human wasn't responsible for triggering that change. Something, the deeper intelligence that was manifesting. And I think we have to look to the divine, or we have to look to the intelligence of the universe, which is systematically evolving, increasingly complex, self-aware, self-empowering manifestations of its energy, of its life. It is taking us into this transition. It is generating these powers of change. What we are doing is cooperating with this process. We're cooperating with it at an individual level, and we're also cooperating with it at a collective level. The collective level, who sees the collective level? I mean, not many people. I mean, deep spiritual practitioners, shamans, sages, visionaries, but most people live their life quite contentedly at an individual level. Nevertheless, what we see from the visionary perspective is what they're doing, what they're working is contributing directly, very powerfully, to this transition taking place at a collective level.
With this collective level, very few people see from that broad perspective or that cosmic perspective. And I think it's really good medicine for the whole, for those that don't see, to hear stories, to see stories of those who can access that intelligence in that big way. I opened with the story of the impermanence of our world and reality and how I saw the world, but you also saw this rising and falling of life forms. You wrote, an endless succession of births followed by deaths, endings blending with beginnings, nothing wasted, everything conserved, a single living flow that exists at a deeper order of reality than our individual lives. Say more about this also, not only this cosmic perspective of that, but when we can see it in these waves of creation, creating from the form to informed, and then like literally that dissolution and more information coming in and reforming the form. There's so many metaphors we could go here, but say more, Chris, because I think it is really good medicine for us to get that larger picture and hear stories of this as this one living dynamic system, even though there is what you say, the pain and the suffering and what's ahead may look grim to some.
This is a type of discussion that we should take place around a campfire in the wee hours of the morning when we have nature all around us and the stars overhead. When a person works, as I have and as many people have, dissolving the fundamental structures of their individual mind, one just dissolves into larger currents of mind, larger patterns of mind. And if you do this work long enough and systematically enough, eventually there's no place to go but into the mind of the creative intention, of the mind of the divine, of the mind of the intelligence of the universe. There's no place else to go. One goes there. And when one goes there, one is given glimpses of, experiences of, immersions into communion with the deeper patterns of creation. It's the most natural thing in the world, even though it looks exotic from one perspective, it's entirely natural. And from that perspective, stepping out of our small time frame of 100 years, stepping into a very, very brief time frame from the universe's perspective of 100,000 years, or 300,000 or 400,000 or 500,000 years, to actually being able to move into the life form that pulses with the pulse of the galaxy, that pulses with that deep, deep current. When you do, or when I have, and this particular vision you're referring to was the last of the great visions that I was given in my journey. It came in the 20th year. It was the very end. It was a culminating kind of journey. And it gave me this experience of what I call samsara in the raw. And I experienced what many mystics have experienced, life as a continual turning over of life forms. It just, everything's temporary. Mountains are temporary. Continents are temporary. Planets are temporary. Lives are temporary. Everything is constantly turning over and turning over and turning over. And in that turnover, there is extraordinary genius, just an extraordinary power, because it's not just, it may be turning over, let's say at the human level. At the surface level, it just looks like it's all just very temporary turning over. It's just a constant turning over. But underneath that, nature is learning. Underneath those temporary forms, there is another form, which is itself temporary, but it changes much more slowly. To experience the patterns of this turnover, to experience, at least as I experience, that nothing was lost. Every learning, every tear, every act of charity, every goodness, every physical exertion, everything was conserved, constantly turning over. Everything from one life and from one generation became part of the next life and the next generation. To experience the entire planet of humanity incarnating in this pulse of reincarnation and carrying their entire learning forward in various reassembled forms into the next generation, and to be given the privilege of the universe holding this learning. First, it created the conditions for this learning, and it created the conditions for all the changes and all the trials and hardships, but all the wonderful, powerful breakthroughs that have taken place and are taking place. What stands out for me right at this moment is the conservation of every effort we've ever expended. Everything is conserved, nothing is lost, and then everything builds into more complex, more sophisticated, more compassionate forms. To realize that this is not a personal story. We participate in this story personally, but it's not a personal story. It's a deeper evolutionary story. It's a species story. It's deeper than the species story. It's a deep, deep story of the divine manifesting in time and space. To me, to experience samsara in the raw, I then began to understand what many spiritual teachers that I had read over the years had been talking about, the wisdom of the short-livedness of the lives that we are living. It's just constantly turning over, but there is profound wisdom in that and grace.
See, I knew that would be good medicine for the listeners to hear those words. It was beautiful. I felt the bonfire and the stars up above. It was a gorgeous dissertation there, Chris. Thank you. That was gorgeous. I could see it on Paul's face too.
Indeed. I honestly, I don't know what else to say right now. That was so beautifully put and inspiring from the breadth and depth of the larger cosmos down to our individual human experience and the vital importance of all of it. Now, as I say that, I do want to bring something up because it's something I had written down, and this will be, I think, just be a reinforcement to some degree of what you just spoke about, Chris. You write in the latter parts of your book that after the diamond luminosity experience had begun its systematic entrance into your physical being, all the subsequent sessions pivoted, that you were repeatedly guided back to the immediate present and to the here and now of your physical life. And I thought that was so beautiful because it was guiding you to what you were just speaking about, I think, the precious nature of each of our individual lives for what that life is, but also what it is contributing to the larger growth of humanity and the larger growth of the expanded cosmos itself. I just found that so beautiful. And it's something that's, I believe, missing in some traditions, the Vedantic being one of them that I had done deep dives into. Our human experience, the earth herself. So anything, if you want to add a little bit to that, fine, or we can move on.
The more I've lived with the experiences that were given me on this journey, and the more I've struggled to try to figure out what to do with them and how to hold them and how to live them and how to respond to them, the challenge of temporary access is really fundamental. I mean, and I think the sessions themselves were basically making a pivot to help me integrate. I mean, it was taking the lead. So there were many sessions going out, experiencing deeper and deeper textures, eventually into the diamond luminosity. But then in the end, it's the diamond luminosity crunching deeper and deeper and deeper into my being, which I wish it had been able to complete that process inside the session so that when this journey ended, I could have this diamond luminosity intact forever in my being as a daily experience. But I found that there was more to do. I had to hold on to my ordinary physically grounded consciousness and hold my seat, so to speak, before this internalization of the diamond luminosity could complete itself. I had literally to not modify my consciousness by going into psychedelic space. I had to hold my consciousness in its physical form to allow this internalization, this integration of diamond luminosity, to complete this process that had gotten started internal to the sessions. The universe is growing us. And it loves us, it's intelligence, and it's growing us. It doesn't want us to run off into bliss in the returning to it. It wants us to take that bliss and bring it back into our being to continue to deepen and accelerate this evolutionary process that it is on, that it is seeding, and it has an idea of where we're going, which is much deeper and more profound than anything we can envision where we're going. We might, in our visionary experiences, have a glimpse maybe into the next 10,000 years. Its perspective is counted in terms of billions of years. Who has the capacity to envision where humanity is going over a billion years? But it does. We cooperate with that. We participate in that, I think, by internalizing our spiritual experiences and trying to see where they can take us in our incarnate existence.
I'm with you, Paul, like speechless at times. I do want to bring back something I dropped in earlier because I think it's an important part of your journey and the learnings and the lessons that you've taken away from this experience, Chris. And so I kind of want to move us into the integration of the last 20 years experience, but you really talk about something important. And I think that I think it's important to presence that you're talking about that living universe, right? And that intelligence. And you said from the beginning, this larger intelligence had been in control of your sessions. And then later in the book, you really saw how that orchestrated the entire 20-year journey. And literally that 73 sessions had that intelligence running through them as one collective journey, like one really important piece. The unification of that is mind-blowing, that something so intelligent and so vast can hold this sometimes years apart and sometimes months apart, but this thread continued in your discoveries. So I would love for you, for those who might not have listened to that first and second session yet, to talk about that journey, but also that it hasn't stopped. Like, the integration process is essential. And where you are today, you had this intuition that 20-year journey would take 20 years, and then you published this book, but it's continuing. Like, it's continuing to percolate in your being, and you're learning, you know, continually and evolving and developing, like, that very intelligence. And I love that vision of that diamond and where you're at with that. Yeah. So let's talk, number one, first about that intelligence that goes through. And then I'm going to remind you to come back around and let's talk about what it was like not to be able to talk and process and share publicly about that process because of the nature of your role, your job, LSD, and we'll go there because it was a painful journey. And maybe this begins, if you talk about that intelligence, we can talk about the painful part of this recovery and integration.
The universe loves us fiercely, but that love is a fierce love, and it's not a gentle love, and it's not a gentle compassion. I mean, it's a love that loves us so much, it breaks us down. It basically strips us down, grinds us up, opens us to new territory, takes us where we've never been before. I've accepted that my doing of this work was part of my soul's agenda. I mean, this was something I recognized as soon as I saw it. I knew I wanted to do it, had to do it. I've come to recognize that this was the way that this incarnation fulfilled its work in the world at several different ways. And one of the ways was to try to understand our world, just to understand the deep structures of our spiritual structure, the deep structure of evolution, the deep structure of the cosmos, to test and probe the intelligence of the universe. I mean, I began this work as an atheistically inclined agnostic, but to actually experience that intelligence and how I experienced it very graphically as I studied my sessions over the hall and tried to hold on to all of them at the same time and really analyze the detail of how one session led to another session and how a theme was stated here and how it was picked up several sessions later and deepened. And when you experience yourself caught up in the magnificent of this intelligence, it just brings you to your knees. It brings you to your knees in gratitude and just adoration. And I think it's the same experience that many scientists, and Paul, you helped me here, many scientists experience when they really encounter something which demonstrates the profound genius of the universe. I mean, DNA, I mean, that's all just profoundly, it just brings us into ecstatic adoration of the process that we are part of. The same intelligence that held all that understanding and brought it back to me, even over gaps of years between sessions, that's the same intelligence that's also orchestrating the expanded memory of the soul, because the soul holds all those experiences. Our psyche holds all these experiences for years and brings it back into our future. So what was happening in the session is the same thing we see happening from other perspectives, past life therapy perspective, or even individual therapy perspective. We're sort of seeing the genius of it and the compassion of the universe in doing so.
So let's transition into the integration process for you and the 20 years, because I think that's an important part of the story. And I know it's really important to you. And for other seekers that might be out there, it wasn't easy for you. And I remember, like, I had a near-death experience as a child and came back going, I don't want to be here. I'm ready to go home. Like, can I go? Like, why? I don't get humans. I don't understand this planet. I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this body thing. And you spent many years waiting to die. You went into depression. You went into a really tough place. Let's talk about that transition and where you are now.
You know, that last chapter, coming off the mountain, was the hardest chapter to write in the book. because I had to kind of sit down and come to terms with what had happened since the journey ended, and come to terms with the consequences of pushing myself as hard as I had and surrendering as deeply as I had into communion with the divine. And by the way, the people I feel the deepest resonance with are near-death episode survivors, because their experiences are the closest to me of my experiences. And so I feel a deep kinship with them. When you've experienced true deep love of a soul partner type, it's hard to go. And if you lose that, ordinary relationships just don't have much of an appeal. And likewise, when you experience the deep, profound beauty of the divine, just the powerful, energetic majesty and intelligence and love of the divine in its kind of what we might think of as its more natural state, or as it is in and of itself, as it lives within itself. And then you come out of that back into time and space, where the membranes of individual life assert themselves and the shadows come down, which keep you from experiencing on a moment-to-moment basis this love that you know is there, and this power and this light that you know is there, but your being prevents you from experiencing it, then you have no other option but really to begin taking down the last levels of the membrane within yourself, because there's nothing but your own foolishness that keeps you from living and breathing this divine grace. After I stopped the sessions, I thought, because I had paid very careful attention to integration all the way through, every session was recorded, really digested them thoroughly, spent years, pondering them, I thought that I could simply stop my sessions and then I would be nurtured by these wonderful gifts that had been given me. And it was over the next several years that I began to realize that my longing to return into the divine embrace was so deep that it made life feel cardboardy. I mean, I didn't have the same zest for living. And I hesitate to call it depression. I know it sounds like that and it looks like that. Because depression has all sorts of, psychiatric ramifications, I think of it as kind of an existential sadness. It's a spiritual sadness. And we know that this sadness manifests in the dark night of the soul in a spiritual practice. And this is kind of different. This is a kind of existential sadness like the NDE person experiences when they have experienced profound communion. They have known the bliss of reunion. And then they come back out of it, and then what? And so I found myself basically waiting to die. I could not go back into those spaces again. I know that I had pushed myself so hard, and I could never just take a massive dose of LSD and pop back into those spaces, because it takes years and years to develop the momentum, the energetic momentum to fuel these kind of breakthroughs. And I knew that I had pushed myself so hard that it really was time for me to stop. I knew that I would not be returning this deeply into the divine embrace until my body fell away. And so I became impatient, waiting for my body to fall away. And I was taking care, I wasn't suicidal, I wasn't depressed in the classic way. I was teaching, I loved to teach, I loved my family, taking care of my family. But still, in my heart of hearts, I was living without the daily experience of my beloved. There was nothing left for me to do in the rest of my life except two things. There was the delivery of the teachings and the insights that I had been given that I was holding for humanity. They had never been just private gifts and private revelations. I had been given them in order to pass them on. So there was the work and the work of passing them on. It was hard in those 20 years, for much of those 20 years, because I wasn't able to talk about this. I couldn't talk about it at the university. I couldn't talk about it to my students. I think it's correct that you can't integrate experiences that you can't talk about. The near-death episode research has shown this very clearly. And I think this is true for psychedelic experiences, that I could integrate them at a certain level, at a personal level, even though I wasn't able to talk about them. I could share them with my wife and with a very small circle. But I'm a talker. I'm a teacher. I need to be able to share and enact in group conversations. And it wasn't until that process was really underway with the writing of the book and the opportunities for conversations like this after the book that the integration process began to reach deeper into my heart. It is as if all my sessions, which live in my mind, is clearly defined. You know, I hold the sessions in my consciousness, but it was like being allowed to talk about them brought their energy together and allowed them to become congealed and to become more powerful. So that the reason I entered into this depression after my journey ended, in spite of the fact that I had integrated each individual session, I learned is that integrating an entire journey is different than integrating individual sessions. The entire journey has a momentum, a magnitude that's greater than any of the individual sessions. And so I entered into this sadness. I was waiting for this process. And over time, over years, I realized that this was not the way this work was supposed to end. I really turned to look at what it was that I had done wrong, if you put it like that, that was causing this existential sadness. And I realized that I had pushed so deeply into the divine that I had lost my foothold inside time and space. So I had gone deeply into the transcendent divine, but had kind of, that was not balanced by an equal penetration into the immanent divine, into the manifest body of the divine inside time and space. So I deliberately stepped away from transcendence and stepped away towards cultivating a relationship with the immanent divine, to celebrating the glory of creation as I saw it manifesting around me every minute and every day and in all the lives. I began just to sort of, I grabbed my life very firmly. I grabbed my physical existence and I held on to it, and I deepened my commitment to live here and now every day that I was alive, until such time as my body falls away. And I will say that I don't know whether I could have made it down this mountain without the love of Christina, my wife, who basically brought me down the mountain, came down the mountain with me, held me during those dark years when I was dealing with this existential sadness, sweetened my life, and basically kind of helped me re-embrace life and its complexity. As I have been sharing, the writing of the book was a very healthy and health-inducing integrating experience. Talking about these experiences, sharing them with people after the book has been published has been very helpful. And at the same time, I know that if I sit still and get quiet, I know that there is this longing. There is this longing for reunion, which is always there. It's managed, never goes away. It's always there. And that's the consequence of kind of pushing yourself beyond your edges as deeply as I had. And I think it taught me that there is a wisdom in not pushing yourself that deeply, in opening yourself less, but holding on to more, and being more patient with the slow reincarnational perfection of our lives. We can push ourselves deeply into the divine. And with the psychedelic renaissance taking place, we are experiencing that it's really not that hard to go deeply into that territory. But at the same time, I think we're learning that holding on to those experiences, nurturing those experiences in our incarnate life, that's a different set of skills. So the universe, my soul told me, there is the dying of seeing and the dying of keeping. The dying of seeing took place in the sessions. I practiced the dying of keeping for the 20 years after my 20-year journey, And I'm still practicing the dying of keeping. It's a lifelong process for me that will be going until the day I die.
Wow. I'm really sad that this is going to come to a close in just a few short minutes here, because I really want to go into that and learn more about that wisdom. But I have one last question I'm going to ask Paul. Do you have one last question? Do you have a closing remark or a question that's really on your heart before we close this series of three conversations with Chris?
I do. Yeah. Chris, I so appreciate you speaking about the sense of pain from having moved away from that ongoing intimacy of experience with the divine. And I thought it would be worthwhile for our listeners to hear about that there is an aspect of our divine experience that can be readily obtained and regularly experienced here in our day-to-day living that I think is important. And what I'm speaking about is this, the oneness consciousness, which you also write about in your book, being in a world where there's no separate units, you wrote, no separate things, even though there was a diversity of color and shape and form, there was no isolation, that the diversity of life does not rupture the oneness. So this is like classic, I think, non-dual consciousness, which people speak about these days, the essential unity and oneness of all life that we are of and are contributing to. And I just thought if you could speak to that briefly, because we live in a world now where we're ruptured by so much division and us and them and on and on. And it's a false perception, as you know. And we as humans, we're blessed that we can overcome that false perception while in a human body. This is something attainable and I think vitally important. And if you could speak to that, I'd be grateful.
Well, there's so many ways to reconnect with the oneness, isn't there? Partly it's just looking around us and reminding us that it's one, reminding us that underneath this diversity, there is a profound unitive wisdom expressing itself. Underneath all these individual, beautiful individual human beings with all their foibles and all their graces, there is a genius manifesting itself in the development of their soul. At a kind of deeper spiritual level, this, you know, was really the focus of this last Diamond Luminosity experience, which was, it took me into the experience of what the Buddhists call the nature of mind, or the innate divinity of our nature. And when we sink into the deepest, deepest level of our individual life, all the differentiating features of our life fall away, and we enter into a level of pristine awareness, which is even deeper than soul awareness. It's a pristine awareness. It's absolute clarity, and thoughts arise from it, and they dissolve in, back into it. Sensations arise, and they fall back into it. And when you sink deeply into it, the stunning realization is it's always been here. It's always been at the center of all my awareness. How could I have missed it? It's always been here. And the other thing, stunning awareness, is this is the essence of every living thing, every insect, every other human being, every leaf at its fundamental core level, it shares this core nature. And so compassion naturally opens, wonder opens. I think the deepest way in which I try to connect with that living oneness is to spend some time tapping into this essence of my life, essence underneath essence underneath essence, and soaking in there and bringing it as deeply as possible into my awareness and sharing it with other beings to make it maybe just a little bit easier for other beings to touch this experience, just as other spiritual practitioners from history, their breakthroughs have made it easier for me to experience this. And the simplicity of the oneness, the compassion of the oneness, and the intelligence of it. Yeah. Yes, life-changing, isn't it?
Chris, thank you so much for all three conversations. It's been great. I hope we have more, and I hope that we work out in the world to, you know, during these next decades of our lives, that we can all work on this evolution of consciousness together. I have a brief question. I'm going to put you on the spot. I know many people ask you, what's the one lesson or what's the one thing? What's the one message? And there were 9 words that jumped out at me. So as a closing question, I'm going to ask you to try to keep it to 9 words yourself, but I'm going to repeat these 9 words because I think they're essential that popped out of the book, sum up the whole value of the book to me. And that was, people need a vision of what we are becoming. I loved that. People need a vision of what we are becoming. So if you can wave a magic wand today and give the listeners a gift of one message of that vision right now, just a brief, succinct vision for them, what would you say?
In our current evolutionary state, we are living kind of a fragmented divinity. We are manifestations of the divine, our essences of the divine, but it's kind of fragmented and choppy, and it doesn't suffuse our entire being. We are coming into a period of history where we are giving birth to a form of humanity that is going to be deeply, fully, consciously saturated with the divine, with everything that implies, a complete change of heart, change of mind, change deep in our body, a change in how our body operates. This is the work of the hour, to manifest that oneness, to manifest that creative energy, that divine energy fully into our lives, and let it be contagious so that it manifests in the lives of people around us until eventually it spreads over the entire planet, and there's not a single corner, a single human being that's outside of the love and the embrace of the divine awareness.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Chris.
Thank you so much for these conversations. I do so value them, and thank you for bringing us all together.
Oh, you are so welcome, and thank you, Paul. I want to leave you listeners with a continuation of that beautiful sentiment from Chris. He writes, "We will realize our destiny. The historical crisis we are entering is the labor that will give birth to the being that has been gestating inside us for countless generations. The diamond soul will be born in history. We will awaken. And when we do, we will see the universe for what it truly is. She is the body of God, the great mother, the diamond maker. With this, everything begins anew." I'm Julie Kroll. You've been listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. This is the Main Street Mystic Series with co-host Paul J. Mills. Remember, together we are creating connections for the good of the whole. Until next time, we're sending you a world of love. Bye for now. If you enjoyed the show, go to your favorite podcast platform. Remember to subscribe, rate, and leave us a review. Also, please consider supporting the Dr. Julie Show at patreon.com/allthingsconnected. When we each give a little, we all get a little more. You can stay in touch with me at juliekrollemail.com. Thanks for listening.